Good afternoon, everyone. It's great for me to be here. It's a tremendous privilege, and thank you for your introduction. Chang Yong asked me to speak about current challenges facing monetary policy, and I'm going to do that from an Australian perspective. And it's quite possible that you find my perspective idiosyncratic. And that's because I come from a country which has had 28 years of uninterrupted growth, a country that has strong population growth, 1.75% a year. I also come from a country that's really the poster child for a flexible exchange rate. We've lived comfortably for 40 years with a fully flexible exchange rate and an open capital account, and we've had a current account deficit for almost 200 years. Although I might just note in the very most recent quarter we had a surplus. But we've had a current account deficit for 200 years and we've lived comfortably with that. There's strong political support for the independent central bank and for the monetary policy framework. And the central bank doesn't have a single or a dual mandate, but has a triple mandate. It's price stability, full employment, and the welfare of the Australian people. And we rely on all three elements when explaining monetary policy decisions. So I said you might find my perspective idiosyncratic, but like every other central bank, we're facing some common challenges, and I want to talk about three of them today. The first is understanding why inflation is so low and so persistently low. The second is understanding why global interest rates are as low as they are and the implications of low interest rates for a small open economy. And the third issue I want to talk about is how we should communicate with the broader public in this complicated world that we're living in. And given the time, I'll just talk about each of these issues for a few minutes. So first, why is inflation so persistently low? Around the world, we're seeing in many countries unemployment rates at 40 or in some cases 50-year lows. It's not just in one or two countries, but it's in a lot of countries. And at the same time, inflation is below most central bank targets. In Australia, our inflation rate's also below the target at 1.6%, although in our case it's partly because we're not yet at full employment. But the general point is that central banks around the world, despite multi-decade low unemployment rates, are having trouble hitting their inflation targets. And the question that we need to think about is, why is that? As some answers say, well, it's pretty obvious, isn't it? U-star, the full employment rate of has fallen, and so there's more spare capacity in our economy, so inflation's low. And I don't find that explanation very useful because it's really just a restatement of the issue. In my view, there's really something structural going on, and that relates to the combined effects of globalisation and advances in technology. Together, these factors have increased competition and they've increased uncertainty. And a combination of increased uncertainty and increased competition mean that the economic systems are less inflation-prone than they once were. I think many people understand that someone somewhere else in the world can do their job perhaps at a lower rate of pay than they're paid. And that includes people in service industries that were previously shielded from international competition. There are now very few non-trader jobs left. So the same pressures that manufacturing workers in the advanced economies felt over recent decades are now being felt in service sectors right around the world. And we see this change very acutely in Australia, particularly our strong trade and people links with Asia. Many services that would previously have been performed in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane can now be done in Asia, and that's affecting wage dynamics. Many firms also wonder or worry that another firm somewhere else in the world might be able to undercut them by having a better technology or better business practices, and that's affecting their pricing decisions as well. So these changes have created an environment in which both wages and prices are less likely to be bid up than they were previously. That means that we can have a lower rate of unemployment than we previously thought. In Australia, our estimate of full employment is now 4.5%. Not so long ago, it was 5%. And it's quite possible, as the evidence accumulates, we'll think we can get even lower than 4.5%. Another significant change we've seen in Australia is a big increase in labour supply, particularly by women and by older Australians. So we've had very strong growth in labour demand. Employment's been running at 2.5% a year. But simultaneously, we've had very strong growth in labour supply. So labour demand strong, labour supply strong. So it's turning out it's quite hard in Australia to create a tight labour market. As a result, wage growth is low, and it's certainly lower than the rates consistent with achieving our inflation target. Now, none of us know whether these global factors affecting inflation dynamics represent a permanent change, but I think we do know that it's highly persistent. It's certainly run for the better part of a decade and probably run for another decade. And the result, we're having quite a lot of trouble hitting our inflation targets. I don't think it's impossible to hit those targets, but it's certainly harder than it once was. The second issue I want to talk about is understanding why interest rates are so low globally and the implications of low interest rates for a small open economy. It's a really important question. There's been a lot of analysis over recent times, not just about the decline in U-star, but the decline in R-star as well. And my perspective is fairly simple here. There's a risk you'll find it simplistic. But at a very high level, what we're witnessing globally is an elevated appetite to save relative to the appetite to invest in new productive capital. When the supply of global savings is very high relative to the demand to use those savings in investing in new capital, it shouldn't be a great surprise that savers get low returns, particularly if you're saving in low-risk assets. The elevated desire to save globally is driven by a few factors, including demographics, the rise of Asia, and the legacy of lots of borrowing in the past. On the other side of the equation, the subdued appetite to invest is a result of the global geopolitical uncertainties, slower population growth, particularly in the advanced economies, and concerns about the underlying pace of productivity growth. And on top of these factors affecting saving investment, we've seen unprecedented action by central banks that have forced long-term interest rates very low. Probably the most striking evidence of this is the fact that the term premium is negative in many countries, minus 1%, when normally the term premium would be expected to be plus 1% or 1.5%. If you accept this diagnosis about why we've got low global interest rates, the key to return to more normal interest rates globally is to improve the investment climate so that firms want to use the pool of global savings to invest in new capital. In principle, the improvement in investment climate could be done through two channels. The first is resolving some of the global geopolitical uncertainties. I think that would reduce the risk premiums required on new capital investment. And the second channel is through structural reforms that give businesses the confidence to invest, expand, innovate, and hire people. Whether or not we'll see these two channels work in practice, I think only time will tell. Certainly both these channels are beyond the control of central banks. In the event that we don't see movement on these two channels, I see a serious risk that monetary policy will become overburdened. If firms don't want to invest at the lowest interest rates on record, reducing interest rates a bit more probably isn't going to shift the dial that much. Sure, it will help at the margin, but we need to be realistic about its impact, and in my view, we're now clearly in the world of diminishing returns to monetary easing. If that's right, then the solution to the problem lies elsewhere, and that, as I said, is creating an environment that encourages investment. Without progress on this front, the main effect of lower interest rates is to push up the price of existing assets rather than encourage investment in new assets, which is what's needed. I admit to feeling uncomfortable about the prospect of the combination of subdued economic growth and higher asset prices. Normally those two things don't go together, but that's what we're seeing. I also admit to being uncomfortable by the perception in some quarters that monetary policy can solve the problem we're dealing with. If that perception takes hold, then there's a high chance that the central banks will disappoint. The consequences of this disappointment are unpredictable, but they're probably not good for the standing of central banks and for the effectiveness of central banks. As a small open economy, we have to take these shifts in global interest rates very seriously. If we sought to ignore them, our exchange rate would go up. As things currently stand in Australia, a higher exchange rate would be unhelpful in terms of both achieving the inflation target and achieving full employment. We have a floating exchange rate, as I said before, and that gives us a degree of monetary independence. but we do have to take these global forces into account. And reflecting the gravity and the pull of these global forces, our monetary policy rate is now 0.75%. That's the lowest on record. In Australia, we've long had a flexible inflation target. Our target is to achieve an average rate of inflation over time of between 2 and 3%. So it's on average over time. And the flexible inflation target is nested within a broader objective of welfare maximisation. I think these aspects of our setup, a flexible inflation target and a broad mandate, means that we have more flexibility than is possible in more rigid frameworks. And given the changing world we're living in, I think this flexibility is a desirable characteristic of our setup. But it does mean that we can't ignore these global developments, and they're affecting our monetary policy decision-making significantly. The third issue is how to communicate effectively with the broad public. In addition to long-standing communication challenges, we face some new ones. Explaining to the public why inflation is so persistently low. Explaining why record low interest rates aren't having their normal effect. Explaining that there are limits to monetary policy. Providing a realistic assessment of the side effects of low interest rates and explaining that there are other policy options. So these are some of the communication challenges that we have. Many in our in the communities that we serve really wonder what's going on. Many people are incredulous that central banks are worried whether inflation is 1.6% or 2 or 2.2 or 2.3. After all, those rates of inflation all constitute price stability. There are also concerns that the lowest interest rates we've seen in many, many years aren't working and are causing distortion. So many people are legitimately concerned about these issues. In response to these concerns, I see real benefits in central bank communication being broadened out beyond inflation and the inflation forecast to tell a broader narrative. And that broader narrative is really built around the welfare of the society. Inflation control is an important part of what the central bank can do to promote the welfare of the society. But we need to remember that inflation control is only a means to an end. And that end is the maximisation of the welfare of the society we serve. So I see real benefits in nesting the inflation control objective within the broader objective of welfare maximisation. I've tried to do this in Australia, and given our mandate, this three-level mandate I spoke about before, which was established back in 1959, hasn't been changed then. Talking about welfare seems natural, and it's a mandate consistent thing for us to do. So the broader narrative about monetary policy shouldn't just be about inflation and the inflation forecast, but it needs to be about financial stability, about jobs, income security and employment growth. The RBA has generally avoided communication in very technical terms. There's certainly a demand from this from financial markets, but highly technical communication doesn't resonate with most of the people in the community that we serve. It's increasingly important that we talk to people in the stories that they can connect with. Stories about the forces shaping the economy, about their incomes, their jobs, the returns on their assets, and also about the trade-offs we face and the limitations to what we can achieve. We're still learning how to do this, but if central banks are to retain the trust of the community, which is very important, I think we need to work on this, and it's something that we're working on. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions. Yes.
Thank you, Governor, for the very informative talk. Before I open the floor, so let me ask you one or two quick questions. Let me focus on your second issue, low R-star. And this is actually a big topic in this annual meeting. The interest rate is too long, too low, and the monetary policy seems to be overburdened. And as a solution, you looks like to suggest some structural reform to increase investment to make R-star go up. But, you know, fund is more short-term oriented. So I believe structural reform will take a longer time. In between, to avoid some negative side impact of this low interest rate, do you think any macro-prudential policies or micro-regulation or even the role of fiscal policy to address the issue in the short term?
Yeah, thank you. That's a good question. As I said, the underlying issue is an imbalance between saving and investment intentions. A lot of people want to save, and not many people want to use those savings to invest in new capital. I mean, structural reform certainly can improve medium-term growth prospects, but I think it can actually make a difference in the short run as well. Because if a country has a comprehensive program of structural reform, firms are more likely to want to invest now and in the next little while. So I don't think it's just about long-term growth. It's about creating an environment today where firms feel confident to invest, expand and innovate. And if we can do that, I think you can change the dynamics quite quickly, particularly if we can reduce the risk premium that firms require for new capital investments. Because you can think about what's happened in the global economies. The risk premium's gone up, and the central banks have lowered interest rates. So that's left the hurdle rate of return unchanged. The lower interest rates are just compensating for the higher risk premium. So if somehow we can reduce the risk premiums, we can get the benefit of the lower interest rates. But unless we reduce the risk premiums, we cannot get the benefit of the lower interest rates because firms' hurdle rates of return on investment don't change. You asked about whether macroprudential policies can offset some of the negative effects of lower interest rates, and I think the answer to that is basically no. I'm not particularly optimistic that macroprudential policies can work, and I say that for a couple of reasons. The first is that many of the risks that people are identifying are really outside the banking system. They're in market-based finance, and we don't have macroprudential instruments to deal with market-based finance, or not very effective ones. And the second point I'd make here is that it would seem curious to me to kind of lower interest rates to stimulate our economy and simultaneously say we're very worried about borrowing. Because the way that lower interest rates work is to encourage borrowing. So to say we want to kind of offset the effect of lower interest rates with macroprudential instruments, which basically limit borrowing, seems to be working against the effect of lower interest rates. So I'm not confident that macroprudential policies can work to offset the effect of the negative effects of low interest rates. You asked about fiscal policy, and in some countries I think there is a role for fiscal policy because fiscal policy is one of the things that's affecting both savings and investment. Now, with properly designed fiscal policy, you can encourage the private sector to invest and the government can reduce public sector savings where there's scope to do that. So I think if we could do this kind of globally, there would be we'd change the saving investment balance and ultimately a return to higher interest rates because firms want to invest. And fiscal policy can be part of the story there. Okay.
So I have many things, but I'm expecting that my fund colleagues will challenge you later. But I'll move to my second question. You mentioned the flexibility of exchange rate worked very well for Australia. Many of my colleagues in ASEAN countries and East Asian countries are very jealous about that because they usually believe FX flexibility sometimes can be a shock amplifier rather than a shock observer. So what kind of recommendation you can make for them to change this shock amplifier situation to the shock observing situation like you?
Yeah, I don't know that I can give them any advice, but I can kind of reflect on our own experience. And because we are really the poster child, as I said, for a country that benefits from a floating exchange rate. For us, the exchange rate is the great stabiliser. Kind of, I don't like saying this, but I think the exchange rate is a better stabiliser than our own monetary policy. Mm-hmm. And there are a few reasons why we're in that position. The first is that our exchange rate tends to move very closely in line with commodity prices. So when commodity prices are high and there's a lot of income coming into the country and investment's high, the exchange rate tends to appreciate. And so that's a stabilising force. A second factor is that exchange rate pass through to prices is fairly limited. Mm-hmm. That's partly because of the credibility of the monetary policy framework and the institutional credibility the country has. So that helps. Another thing that helps is that Australian businesses aren't really well integrated into global supply chains because of the structure. Our exports is largely commodities. So that's not something that many countries in Asia face. I think another thing that's been really important for us is that while Australian companies borrow offshore in foreign currency, right, as do many companies in Asia, they are always able to hedge those foreign currency borrowings back into Australian dollars in the swaps market. So they effectively turn their foreign currency borrowings into Australian dollar borrowings using the foreign currency swaps market. That's a really important element of our setup. And that ability to do that has emerged over time. When we first started floating, it didn't really exist because the hedging markets didn't exist. when we started floating in the early 1980s, there was a tendency to try and control the exchange rate. You know, we used to do, well, it wasn't called intervention, it was called smoothing and testing. And we did that a lot, but over time we felt like it was actually better to let the exchange rate move a lot. Mm-hmm. And I say that mainly because it affected people's incentives. When the exchange rate starts moving a lot, businesses know they have to hedge. They learn, the psychology develops, I have to hedge, and the market's developed to support that hedging. Yeah. So if you don't let the, my advice kind of to the extent that I ever give it is kind of you've got to let the exchange rate move, and it's always uncomfortable when it's moving, even in our flexible system. Sometimes you look at the exchange rate and say, well, we don't really like that, but in the end it's good for you. And one reason it's good for you is that it creates the incentives for both businesses and the institutional structure to develop that then allows you to later live with a flexible exchange rate. But if you don't let the exchange rate move, the culture and the institutions don't develop to, that allows you to live with a flat exchange rate, and you say it's all too hard.
Well noted.
Yep.
We have about 8 minutes, so less than 8 minutes, so why don't I open the questions? The gentleman over there, Dan.
Thank you. My name is Lorenzo Giorgiani. I have a question on monetary policy. You mentioned that Nehru might be even below 4.5. You're now at 5.2% unemployment rate. You're below the inflation target. It sounds like the RBA has still a lot of work to do in terms of delivering monetary policy easing, and you might be soon hitting the zero lower bound. Should we assume you're soon going to go to negative rates or other forms of less orthodox monetary policy implementation? Thank you.
Yeah, that wouldn't be the assumption I'd encourage you to make. And actually, the economy is kind of, it's been through a very soft patch over the last year, but it's actually gradually improving. The lower interest rates are working. The commodity cycle is now kind of in a slight upswing. So the resource sector, which has been a contraction on the economy for the last 6 or 7 years, is now in expansion phase. We've had some tax cuts, and the housing market, which had been in decline for the last year and a half, has now turned around. So that's going to support household consumption. So I think it's quite probable that we'll see a return to trend growth over the next year, which will be good, which will help get the unemployment rate down, and gradually wages will pick up. So I don't think it's the right assumption to make that we're going to have a lot more work to do to get inflation back to target and growth back to trend. It's possible, but I wouldn't assume it.
Okay. Other questions? While then we are waiting for question, I have one immediate question by listening to your speech. You mentioned that you think about the global environment. Given the global interest rate goes down, you're worrying about some spillovers for the exchange rate appreciation, so you adjust the interest rate because inflation to be consistent with the inflation target, right?
Yeah.
Is that kind of trend will cause some kind of competitive devaluation across the world? If everyone is thinking about the low in global interest rates impact on the exchange rate appreciation, whatever the monetary framework, they have to adjust it, then everyone cut the interest rate. So in some sense, indirectly, they're worrying about appreciation. So it's a kind of competitive devaluation?
No, I don't see it in those terms. It's not like we're trying to compete to get the exchange rate low, but no one wants, or very few countries at the moment want a higher exchange rate. Okay. Most people would like more jobs and a bit more inflation. Mm-hmm. And a lower exchange rate helps with that. So if the major countries are cutting interest rates, because global rates are coming down, and as a small open economy, you don't cut your interest rate as well, what happens to your currency? It goes up. Yeah. And that's not helpful. So it's not, I don't see this as a competitive depreciation. It's really the way that the system's responding to shifts in global interest rates. And I think there's an issue about the effectiveness of monetary policy here, though, because one of the channels through which monetary easing works is through the exchange rate. We all know that. But if we all ease monetary policy at the same time, which is broadly what's happening, there is no exchange rate effect for any of us. You know, we don't trade with Mars, we trade with one another. So we all kind of ease monetary policy hoping to get the exchange rate channel. And if we all do it, it doesn't work. So we're left with the other channels of monetary policy transmission, which at the moment are pretty muted.
I think I
so
was.
This is why, I'm kind of skeptical about the benefits of monetary easing to deal with the global problem we face, which is high risk premiums. Yeah. You can't offset high global risk premiums with adjustments in interest rates.
I was a little bit impatient. I should have waited for questions. Given that we have only 4 minutes, why don't I take three questions all together and ask, Governor to answer all together. Okay, so Donghee and the gentleman over there and gentleman over there. So quick questions, okay?
Very illuminating speech. My question is on the risk premiums. So what's your view on the role of monetary policy in influencing risk premiums? And also, is there any difference between risk premiums in taking risks in real investment? You seem to be alluding to that. But also, we seem to have this view that risk premiums in financial risk taking has been actually quite low. So,
And then another gentleman in the middle. Sorry, I cannot see. Is Tommaso?
Sean Roach, S&P. Actually, a question about how you think about the trade-offs between, say, negative rates and QE, should you need to go there? What are the costs and benefits of both of those options in Australia specifically?
And one more question there, and then we'll close the floor.
Thank you so much, Governor. My question has to do with the channels that you suggest for resolving the balance between investment and savings. And I wonder what you make of the more pessimistic theories that say that most of that has to do with demographics in advanced economies. So even if you resolved geopolitical uncertainties, that imbalance might still be there, less need for investment and more need for savings.
Now, Governor, you have 3 minutes. That will allow minus 1 minute for others, so please.
On whether monetary policy is driving the higher risk premiums, I don't really think that's the underlying issue here. There's an endless list of geopolitical uncertainties, which I'm not going to recite them all in this building.
Please do.
But there are also large uncertainties about technology and about the effect of globalization on firms' businesses. They're the underlying uncertainties that businesses talk about, not monetary policy. I think you're right in identifying a distinction between the risk premiums required on new capital investment and the risk premiums required in investing in existing assets, particularly financial assets. Those risk premiums are compressed partly because of what's going on with monetary policy. But what's ultimately important for the real economy is the risk premiums that firms require on investing in new physical assets, and they're very high for the reasons I just talked about. And the solution to the problems we face is to reduce those risk premiums and to give firms the confidence to invest again. If you don't mind, I'm not going to speculate on kind of negative interest rates and quantitative easing in Australia, other than to say I think negative interest rates are extraordinarily unlikely in my country. And on savings investment issues, I think demographics is really important in driving the rise in global savings. Populations are aging, people are living more years in retirement. And if you look at the global demographics, the share of people in the working age years had been steadily rising for decades, and now it's declining. So there are more and more people in peak saving years, and we know we're going to be in retirement for more years, and people haven't saved enough for that. Particularly with income growth having slowed down, people are not generating the income that they used to, so they're having to save more for the retirement, and that's having a first-order effect on global saving outcomes. I think the rise of Asia as well with the high saving rates, that's driving global savings higher. So that suggests that interest rates are going to be low globally for a long period of time unless we can change the dynamics about investment. And I'm optimistic that that can be done. Now, if we can reduce the risk premiums, reduce some of the global uncertainties, and governments commit to comprehensive programs of structural reform, businesses will start investing again at a rate we haven't seen for a long period of time. After all, since the financial crisis, there really is a shortfall of investment. So the capital stock in many of our countries is getting depleted. Not just business capital stock, but the infrastructure capital stock is being depleted. So if we can reduce the risk premiums and we have low rates, I think investment could pick up quite quickly, even with the kind of elevated global saving. But the fact that global savings is high, I mean interest rates, I think, are going to stay low for a long period of time. Let's not hope as low as they are now, though.
Yes. Thank you. I think I have to close this wonderful learning opportunity given the time constraint. But we all know that Governor Lowe has a serious concern on low interest environment. So, with that said, thanks very much for Governor.
Thank you.